Episode 574 is live. Here it is on your listening device, whatever you use. Welcome to the show today. It is January 18th, another beautiful sunny day in Los Angeles. It was in the 80s all weekend and just stunning. Mid-January. Feels like fucking mid-June. There's no global warming, though. I don't know what you're talking about, man. That stuff is all fake. It's fabricated. I did the research. I'm a scientist, or at least I took science in junior high. I know one thing. There ain't no global warming. Fucking scorcher today. Anyway, welcome aboard. Great guest today in the AC/DC history, the AC/DC family. We have none other than Mark Evans, former bass player for AC/DC. He played right up until Let There Be Rock was released, and then he was let go. But now he plays in the great Rose Tattoo. It was amazing to talk to this man. I had so many questions for him over the years that you just don't know. You know, why were you fired? How did you get into the band? How do you guys write tunes? What was your first bass? All this great stuff. And Mark kicked ass on it. Thank you, Mark, for doing the show. You were a killer, man. You rocked it. Definitely. And I want to thank all of you guys for joining me. I know a lot of you are, semi-new here from when I had Angus and Brian and Phil and Cliff on. And thank you so much for taking the ride still and enjoying this podcast. I love this band more than anything on the planet. Everybody knows that. And I just want to know everything about the band. Especially as I get older and look back on all the great memories of seeing this band live. I keep digging. I love you, AC/DC. And Mark Evans is part of that history and family, so it was great to have him. Quick shout out to the new Patreoners. I do have a Patreon page. It is patreon.com/DeanDelRay. Every week I drop a bonus episode. I also do a weekend Zoom fest with all of you that are subscribers, where I fire up the Zoom and let you all hang out. We talk about whatever, books, music, movies, comedy, anything. Patreon.com/DeanDelRay. New Patreoners are Clayton Percola, and Greg Riley bumped up his pledge, so he must be doing good at the motorcycle world there, El Cajon Harley. Also, I don't know what's going on with you guys. Have you been doing a lot of working out in your house during the COVID? I know the gyms are closed in most places. You got sore muscles from the new workout routine. You got to get some CBD topicals for the relief. That's what I've been using, CBD Lion, over a year now, rubbing this stuff on my neck, and it is fantastic. CBDLion.com. Use the code DEAN for 20% off everything. They've got the edibles and gummies. They have the bath bombs. Yes. Yes, you can take a bath, drop some CBD in there, and disappear. They got the tinctures. Just drop it under your tongue and sleepy time. No more anxiety. CBD combo packs. You can get two or three of these items and save on that. CBD patches. They got the sports tape. CBDLion.com. None of that truck stop CBD. That stuff is bunk. Don't get your CBD at 7-Eleven. What are you doing? Are you the same person that gets pizza at 7-Eleven? Come on. You ever see that guy getting pizza at 7-Eleven? I see it in New York. I'm in New York. Guy's getting pizza in 7-Eleven. Then he's picking up some CBD. I'm like, you are trying to die quick. Get the clean third-party CBD from CBD Lion, my official sponsor for the last year. These guys are the best. Family-owned. Oh, and they got pet tinctures too and treats. You got a cuckoo pet? I've been hooking up my little Gertie. I got the French bully named Gertie, and she loves, I don't know if she loves the CBD or she just wants more treats, but she's been mellow. CBDLion.com. Somebody just drove by in a goddamn hot rod. These fucking people making the noise. Get off my lawn. Someone yelling at him right now. I can hear him out there. Shut up. All right, guys. I love all of you. Enjoy this Mark Evans episode and then go throw on Let There Be Rock and just enjoy your day. Candles are lit. Here he is, Mr. Mark Evans.
Hey, how about that, huh?
There you are.
Hey, how you doing, pal?
I'm good. How about you, man?
Yeah, feeling good. It's 11 a.m. in the morning. It's going to be a beautiful day here, around about 85 degrees at the moment. So, hey, we're doing okay, you know?
Yeah, it's summer out there, right?
Absolutely. Oh, Sydney's always summer. You know, like we don't really have a winter here. It's a bit sort of like, you know, a bit like Southern California. We don't really get a lot of, we don't have snow or stuff like that. So whereabouts are you?
I'm in Los Angeles.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I know it well. I lived there for a number of years. Yeah.
Where were you out here?
I was in North Hollywood, just and then up in the hills for a while, Bel Air. But when I first moved there, I went over there and joined an Australian band,
Heaven.
Called Heaven. And we were near the corner of Lancashire and Victory in North Hollywood.
What in a band house?
Yeah, I had a band house. Michael Browning, our manager, was real big on having a band sticking together, you know, similar to what I did with AC/DC very early on in St. Kilda down in Melbourne. There was a band house. Yeah, that was interesting, the band house for AC/DC, let me tell you. It was pretty busy, man.
Yeah, I can imagine, man.
We had a very good social director too. We had Bon Scott, you know, leading proceedings, so we're doing okay, you know.
What a time to be in that band, you know, to think about it. It's those records, of course, TNT, High Voltage, Let There Be Rock, Dirty Deeds.
Yeah.
That is an electric era of that band, right?
Yeah, well, when I very first joined the band, when it would have been, you know, late March 1975, the band, I'd heard of the guys, I'd heard of the band, but it was very, very early days. Like, we were doing shows in Melbourne, the first few shows. So the first show I did with them, there was probably about 15, 20 people there. It was very, very early on. The first album just started to make, you know, a bit of a dent. And it was very much because of a national TV show we used to have over here called Countdown, run by a guy called Ian Meldrum.
I saw that footage.
Oh yeah, well, see, the first time I was on Countdown with the band, I'd only been in the band 3 days, and it's a video of us doing "Baby Please Don't Go" with Bon dressed as a schoolgirl. What the fuck have I got myself into here? You know,
what was the idea of that? Was it like, let's try to shock, or were you guys trying to find the identity of the band? I know Angus went through some different outfits and different stuff. What was going on there?
Oh, the band, you know, that was purely just Bon having fun. Having fun. He was going to do something different, you know, and back in those days, there wouldn't have been too many other front guys that'd be, you know, he would even think, you know, put themselves in a situation like that, where they'd be so sort of open to ridicule. But he just made it work, man. It was just something else. It was a very interesting human being, you know, very interesting. A lot of fun, man.
Were the brothers mad that he did that? Because here's your first.
Oh no 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 he, no, no no it was no they were all for it, you know, all for it, man. It's yeah, you know, there's a very interesting quote from Malcolm that I've seen a few times, and I think it's Malcolm George and Angus and. Yeah, the older brothers too. Very astute people, you know. I think there has been a tendency over the years to underestimate them and dismiss them as being, you know, unidirectional or whatever have you. But they're all, bless their hearts. They're sharp dudes, man. And the whole thing was meant. It was, you know, should have had a big stamp on, not to be taken seriously. The whole thing was the music. And have some fun while you're doing it, you know? Yeah, it's a great time. Great time, man.
Let's get into your early days of course, you played guitar before you played bass. And you hear about the audition.
Oh, research.
Oh, well, I mean, we're talking about a band that I've been listening to since 78, you know?
Oh, yeah, well, I beat you by 3 years. I've been listening to the band since 75, man.
Yeah. So you go down an audition and Bond's not even at the audition. Is this right?
Yeah, that's right. You know, yeah, what happened was I was one Saturday afternoon, I was playing pool in my local pub called the Station Hotel from a suburb in Melbourne, inner east suburb called Paran. And my local pub was Station Hotel, and I went in there to have lunch and have some beers. And a guy I used to play football with, a guy called Steve McGraw, was in there, and he just finished a stint with them being a roadie. He said, "Well, this guy's looking for a bass player, man. You've got a Fender bass, you've got this, you should go down and see him." And what got my attention, he said, "There's two guys in the guitar players, younger brothers to George Young." And all the lights went on for me. He said, "Yeah, George Young, you have Easy Beats?" He said, "Yeah." So, "What's the address, man?" You know, and it just basically started from there. They never really asked me to join the band, but I sort of got there and, ran through the first album with them. They gave me a copy of the album, went back the next day, played it. And then the following Tuesday night, they were playing, of all places, Station Hotel in Paran. And I went there with a couple of buddies of mine, and the band were playing at that stage as a four-piece. Malcolm was playing bass. And I've got to tell you,
what's Mike on bass, man? Because Angus said he's killer on bass.
We were standing there, my buddies who are actually in a band with it at that stage, still my best buddy, a guy called Graham Kennedy. That's another story. He's actually from Glasgow. And he said, "What are they changing this for?" I said, "I don't know what they're changing." Malcolm was just like, as far as a bass player, it's just like, I don't see I've seen any better. But, you know, Angus and Malcolm are both like that. I think whatever they set their minds to, they're very strong-willed. They can do it. And they're not, you know, I think they're very confident. Excuse me, I know I'm talking about Malcolm in the present tense here. That's just happens. I still speak about Bond in the present tense. I don't know why. I don't really do it with anyone else that we've lost over the years, but it just seems to be the way it happens with me, you know. But Malcolm is a bass player, killer, man. Also, George Young's an amazing bass player too.
Yeah, well, George Young played some of that stuff on the TNT and part of the High Voltage record. You come in and play half of High Voltage, correct?
On the international version of it, you're probably aware, most people will be aware now that the original High Voltage album internationally was a combination of parts of TNT and parts of High Voltage.
Correct.
George played bass on a lot of that early stuff, but there was also another bass player that was in the band, the guy directly before me, a guy called Rob Bailey, who did play on some of the tracks on that album. That was interesting times. You know, I was very fortunate to be taken under, George Young took me under his wing, And the whole thing was a very steep learning curve for me. But, yeah, so there was, I met Steve McGrath at publishing, go around, see the guys. I learned the album, went back the next day. And then the following Tuesday night, I was going to see a four-piece AC/DC who were mind-blowing, man. And as I mentioned before, I was with a pal of mine, Graham Kennedy, who was from Glasgow. And he's standing there and he said, you know, oh, the guitar player, Jim from Glasgow, right? I said, yeah. He said, it's Angus and Malcolm, right? I said, yeah, that's their names. He said, no, they know my cousin, Roy McIntyre. I used to play football with him in the streets outside their housing projects in Cran Hill. So my best pal used to play soccer with him in the streets in Glasgow, which is one of those weird weird coincidences. Yeah, yeah. Weird stuff, man.
When you go into play bays, you were a guitar player. How are you approaching the audition? Are you just playing the straight notes, real simple bass lines? How did that go down?
Oh, well, I started off playing guitar, but in a band with my mate Graham and Mickey, and a guy called Mickey Smith playing drums. I was playing bass then. So I had a history. I started off in guitar like most people do. But, I think most people start playing bass because there's two guitar players or three guitar players and someone's got to play bass. But I've still got a history of playing a lot of guitar now. In heaven, I played guitar and I had an acoustic blues duo with a good pal of mine. Yeah, so I love playing guitar, but if you ask me, I'm a bass player, man. You know, that's what it is.
During that era, what were you playing? P-Bass, Ampeg, SVT, what was that?
Oh, Ampeg, SVT, man, yeah. Early on, I was just using Fender Precision Basses, and they've basically been my go-to thing ever since. But now with Rose Tattoo, I've gone back to Gibson basses again. I'm using some Thunderbirds and Ripper basses, and I had a couple of Ripper basses with AC/DC, and still got some of them. But with Rose Tattoo now, Thunderbird basses. They're great, man. There's a lot of coincidences, a lot of links between AC/DC and Rose Tattoo.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. I just had Angry.
Of course,
yeah. Yeah.
Hey, my boss. He's my boss, man. Yeah. Yeah. He's angry. He's a good one, man. He's along with Bon, as far as frontmen go, they're the top of the tree, pal. Top of the tree.
What were those early days in AC/DC like as far as writing? Were you guys just in a rehearsal studio writing, or did the brothers just come in and say, here it is, and then Bon wrote the lyrics and it moved on?
Well, my first experiences with recording, was with AC/DC. And I thought the way we were doing it was the way everyone did it. But I can tell you, for the period I was with the band, we never rehearsed. We just, I think we moved to England. We checked all the gear was working once we got over there, and then went to the pub. And as far as the recording goes, Phil and myself wouldn't really hear anything before we went in the studio. All the songs were basically written in the studio. We'd record over a 2-week period. And the first week would be writing and putting down the backing tracks, and the second week would be reserved for getting the vocals and the lead solos done. But all the backing tracks would be recorded in the first week, written and recorded from the first week from go to woe. That's how we're, and no demos or whatever. Occasionally the guys might come up with a guitar thing. We might sort of belt through it during a sound check. Bad Boy Boogie was like that. We'd be messing around. I heard it a couple of times at sound check, but that was it. Everything was written in the studio. And TNT was done like that. Dirty Deeds was done like that. And Let There Be Rock was recorded like that. And I think it's interesting to note with those albums, the first four AC/DC albums were basically recorded in a 2-year period.
Wow.
So four albums, you know.
Wow.
I think High Voltage was recorded in November. I'm pretty sure I got this timeline right. November 1974, that was recorded. And then Let There Be Rock was recorded in December and January, December 1976. So, yeah, it's just a little bit over 2 years those four albums were recorded. And you look at the change between the Five Voltage album and the Let There Be Rock album.
Oh, man.
There's massive amounts of changes there. You know, and I've been asked this a number of times, and speaking from my position in the band at the time and what I've come up with, like, in hindsight, to me, Let There Be Rock sounds like the first AC/DC album to me. You know, that's where the band has found itself, you know. And it changed really quickly. And then after Let There Be Rock, you've got Power Rage and Highway to Hell. And I don't really think I'm either the best person to say this or the worst person to comment on this. But I look at those three albums, Let There Be Rock, Highway to Hell, and Power Rage. I think there is three albums in a row is just about as good as anyone's recorded, you know. I might be, you know, sound like a buffhead saying that, but not so much, because the only one I was involved in really was Let There Be Rock. But those Power Rage and Highway to Hell, they, you know, they stand up. They're great albums, man. You know, I got a lot of respect and love how the bands continue on as it has. And I think that's never been more brought into focus for me other than in the last few weeks with a new album coming out. And, you know, I've got a lot of respect and love for the guys, you know, that. I'm so pleased that they've put it together like they have, and I don't want to be standing on anyone's feet here, but so I'm really personally so pleased the lineup is what it is. It's the right lineup, you
know? Absolutely,
because Phil's back in there, and Phil is integral to the band's sound. Yeah, you know, would you go see the Stones without Charlie Watts?
No. No,
it wouldn't be the band. And I think Keith, you know, on record saying, "Oh, you know, well, we'll keep going as long as Charlie's there." It's the Stones, and you know, Phil's been in and out of the starting lineup a couple of times for whatever reason. But I think it's the perfect lineup. It's the lineup as it is now. It just picks itself, man. I'm just really pleased that it's happening the way it is. It's a good way. It's a good thing, man.
Honey is my new sponsor. What is Honey? I'm going to tell you right now. We all shop online, and we've all seen those promo code field taunt us at the checkout. You know, like, hey, add your promo code for the discount, and then you don't have one. You're like, what? I need a discount code. But thanks to Honey, manual searching for those coupon codes is a thing of the past. Honey is the free browser extension that scours the internet for promo codes and applies the best ones it finds to your cart. Honey supports over 30,000 stores online. They range from sites that have tech and gaming products to popular fashion brands and even food delivery. This is how it works. Imagine you're shopping on one of your favorite sites. When you check out, the Honey button drops down, and all you have to do is click Apply Coupons. Wait a few seconds as Honey searches for coupons it can find for that site. If Honey finds a working coupon, you'll watch the price drop immediately. Honey has saved me some crazy money. I bought some boots, saved $20, and the dog food I was buying online, I saved $25 on. And I'm always looking for coupons. And whenever I'm manually looking for them, they're just burnt up, they're expired, all that. So this is just unbelievable. And I am a shopping online freak. And so are we all right now. during the COVID. This doesn't cost you any money at all right? Honey has saved over 17 million members over $2 billion in savings. This is crazy. This is just a no-brainer, guys. It's free, and it helps you. It helps me, and it's so great. If you don't already have Honey, you could be straight up missing out on free savings. It's literally free, and it installs in seconds. And by getting it, you'll be doing yourself a solid and supporting this podcast. Help us out here, Dale Razors. Do this. Get Honey for free at joinhoney.com/Delray. That's joinhoney.com/Delray. D-E-L-R-A-Y. All right. Now do this. Let's talk a little bit about some of that early kind of the grinding touring that AC/DC was doing all over the UK nonstop, multiple shows. At what point do you start to see the band getting a little bigger? Because I know right before Let the Be Rock, the label is ready to drop the band. The band is completely packing shows, but the label didn't like Dirty Deeds. So at what point do you guys really see this band starting to light up with the people? Was it a long haul or was it pretty fast?
Well, everything... You know, of course, I can only comment on the period I was with the band. And then if you look at the timeline of the band, the time I was with the band is a relatively short period.
Right.
It's only like two and a half years or something. But a lot happened. It's a very formative time. It moved really, really quickly. Like, as I mentioned before, you know, so I saw them at the Station Hotel, a local pub in Paran, and playing to 15 people. And then... the road crew come up to you, Ralph the Roadie Company, and says, "Oh, you know, it's great you're with the band now. I've got two pieces of information for you." I said, "What's that?" He said, "Well, always remember it's Malcolm's band and we're going to be in England in 12 months' time." And I looked at him and said, "You may say, we're going to be playing on the fucking moon in 12 months' time, you know?" It was just such a ridiculous thing to hear. I've gone, "Oh, hey, that's great. Let's go." And I was just speaking to my pal and said, "There's no way this band's going to be in England in 12 months' time. Forget about it." It's just like, and I was right. It didn't take a year. It took a year and 10 days. They were 10 days behind schedule. But that I think that goes to the vision that Angus and Malcolm, but particularly Malcolm, and along with George, had for the band. You know, it's they, Angus and Malcolm with the band, they started at a bit of a high level, because once I think Angus got over the shock that Malcolm wanted me to play in a band with him, you know, it moved quickly, because they're not like saying, "Okay, we'll put a band together and we'll write some songs and we'll find a bass player, we'll get a singer, and we'll go, you know, in 6 months' time, we'll go do some gigs," you know. It wasn't that. It was, "Okay, we're putting this band together. We're gonna go for it." And then they because I've grown up looking to George, who was in the Easy Beats, for a band that essentially came from Australia, they were massive here. So it wasn't normal for them to think, "Oh, everyone's band's like that." You know, they set the bar really high from the start. Their brother was in this band. "Oh, if George can do that, we can do that." So it starts from not like, "Oh, you know, we're going to try and get some gigs." You know, there was it wasn't aspirational at all. He says, "Well, we're going to do this." It was, "Oh, well, we'd like to do this." It's that we're going to do this. And I really don't think anything has changed all along. You know, it's some people call it arrogance. I would choose to call it confidence.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about those marquee gigs, that were on the iconic marquee gigs. I guess they were done right there around the Let the Be Rock, time. But the energy in those shows had to be explosive, because now here you guys, you're living on over in England, right? And and it's starting, you know, punk rock is getting big, and you guys are getting
it was an unusual time.
Yeah, you're getting way more aggressive, you know, stuff like Go Down, Let There Be Rock. The tempos are crazy fast. They're brutal. I think Let There Be Rock is, I don't really say it a lot because I don't have the time to argue, but it is the greatest AC/DC record with Bond to me. It's just so, so raw.
Yeah. I'm probably, like I said, either the best or the worst person to comment on particularly that album. But I think it's a real watershed album for the band. We recorded that after our first trip to England. And to me, like as I mentioned, it sounds to me like the first AC/DC album. I can listen to that album now, and I got to tell you, I really enjoy it. And it's quite surreal thinking that now, I think, what's that album recorded 40 years ago?
Longer.
No, 1977, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's 44 years ago, whatever, you know. I'm no good with figures unless there's dollar signs in front of them. It's a bad joke. I'm using someone else's phrase there. But, that album to me, that's – I can listen to those records, particularly those group of three records we mentioned, and they sound like they could have been recorded last week to me. And I think it's a lot to do with George and Harry and that Albert sound, which is was certainly not invented by AC/DC, but it was developed from a long line of great Australian rock bands like Billy Thorpe and particularly a guy called Lobby Lloyd, who had a band called The Coloured Balls. They're just like mind-numbingly loud, but there's this attack and a presence and a intensity.
Yeah, I talked to Angry about that pub rock sound.
Angry knows, man. He's been in the coalface of my favorite band in the whole universe, Rose Tattoo, for a long time, and it's like Christmas every day now. I'm in Rose Tattoo. It's a long way around to come to join a band, but it's been a very, very interesting journey. I've had a lot of really good pals that have been in Rose Tattoo, and it's a real big deal for me to be working with Angry now to continue on the journey for a lot of our pals that can't make it. And yeah, I think it adds a gravitas to it that makes it all the more special. And I think I'm not comparing the two bands, but I think there's a sense of importance that the band continues on to its logical conclusion with Rose Tattoo that is very important. And I can only imagine that that's the same thing that runs through the veins of AC/DC. It's what it is. It all comes to an end some stage, and I don't quite know where it is, but it's going to be good. It's going to be very interesting, and it's going to be done in the right fashion, I'm sure. And with AC/DC, with this record coming out, man, I haven't heard the whole thing, but I've just heard that single. And, mate, that's kicking up some dust, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. A lot of respect for those guys, man.
Who would make the set list back then, you know, and on the AC/DC tours? Was it Bond? Was it Malcolm? Who would make the set list?
Oh, that's another interesting point about that band. Like I said, we never rehearsed or did any demos. We never had a set list either.
Really?
There's no set list. Yeah. Yeah. I'd never even seen a set list till I was outside of AC/DC.
Wow.
Because we'd go on, and the whole thing, we'd start once we had recorded TNT, what we used to do, we'd always start off with Livewire.
Right.
Because and it almost negate the need to have a sound check. It just starts off with the bass and the hi-hats, and then Malcolm's guitar starts looking in, and it builds up. So even it comes in at different times. So we'd start off with that song, and what we'd do, we'd start off with Live Wire, and we'd finish with Baby Please Don't Go, and then once Let There Be Rock was recorded, the finishing song would be Let There Be Rock. Yeah, no set list, man.
Wow. Did you guys ever dig in to some of those deep tracks? I think that are incredible, like Squealer or Soul Stripper. Did you guys ever play that stuff live?
Yeah, right when I first joined the band, Soul Stripper was a very important part of the set because we only had one album to choose from, which was the Australian version of High Voltage. I get messed up with the track listings of the albums because they change from overseas. I think a lot of the stuff that was left off the international High Voltage album turned up in America. It's called Jailbreak 74.
Right. Yeah.
They regurgitated. Yeah. But yeah. But it's Soul Strip is an interesting song because I with the fans, I think it's fairly common knowledge, but you know, Malcolm's regarded as, you know, he's a rhythm player, you know. But you listen to Soul Stripper, and there's an instrumental part where the guitar solos are, and Angus and Malcolm answer each other on solo. So you got Malcolm and Angus both playing solos in it. Wow. And I've got to tell you, it's pretty good, you know. But I think. You know, Malcolm got the idea to say, I'm the rhythm player. You Angus, you go for it, you know.
Yeah.
And that's why it worked out, you know.
As you guys start playing more and more, do you really start to develop these long jams? Because there's long jams in these live sets. Just from playing live, just looking at each other like we're just going to ride this out and let Angus go for it here and then know when to come back in?
Yeah. It's from what I understand, I've always been a big Rolling Stones fan, right? A big, you know, Keith and Charlie fan. From what I understand, how that band works to the way AC/DC worked when the time I was in the band, it's very similar. The band would follow Malcolm. But Malcolm would be watching it and be watching what Angus and Bond would be doing because they could get up to anything. Early in my time with the band, Angus had a gorilla suit, right?
I remember that.
And be completely correct. And then Bond would have this Tarzan thing. And we've done gigs. It'd be on PA and Bond would have a rope tie. And he'd be swinging from side to side in the PA boxes. Like we did that in Furstville Hall. It was like a Tarzan thing. You know? So – with Angus and Bond, they would just bounce off each other, and you know, it's at the time you sort of knew there was something going on there, but it's only in the fullness of time you look back and go, wow, no wonder people liked it so much, you know.
Yeah.
They were good front too. They, you know, those guys, you know, it's like they There was a great sense of humor about the band. Like, how can you write songs like Big Balls or She's Got Balls, you know? We weren't writing Dark Side of the Moon, for fuck's sake, you know what I mean? There was this fun. Bond's lyrics are brilliant, and I can't help but draw the line between AC/DC and Rose Tattoo, because once again, Angry is his lyrics and stuff are brilliant. And actually, Bon and Angry were very, very close. And you know, it's a matter of record these days that you know, Bon was very, very, very important and very integral of getting Rose Tattoo a deal with Albert's.
Yeah,
you know, Bon used to follow the Tats around and go up and get and sing with them, you know, I saw a couple of things he really got up and sang with him. Just one of those, some of those magic nights, you know?
Yeah, yeah. What was Bon like? You're one of the few people that was around him daily. You know, obviously we know he wasn't just this lunatic drunk the entire time, or it would have never worked. But what was he really like?
Well, there seems to be in some areas a portrayal of Bon being, you know, this out of control dude, you know, and sure he could be, but like we all got out of control back in those days, you know. He was our social director, you know. Within the band, he was called the old man. He said, "What's the old man doing?" You know, because when I joined the band, I was 19, and Bon was 29.
Wow.
So it was like being on the road with your mad uncle. You know, everyone's got a mad uncle. Yeah. The one that drinks too much at weddings, and it was like that. You know, it was just. He looked like Fonzie on the outside, but inside there was this, you know, a really sort of a, you know, a bit of a hippie sort of 60s love child sort of thing in there. He was, it's great fun to be around, an absolute gentleman. On Monday nights when we were based in Melbourne, I never lived in the band house. I lived in housing projects about 2 miles from the band house. It's sort of these housing projects in Melbourne. They're all around the city. It looks a bit like, that Bedford Stuyvesant in New York, you know?
Yeah.
It looks exactly like that, you know? 12-story, 20-story blocks. And so Bon used to come around every Monday night, and we have roast lamb, and he used to be out washing dishes with my mom and, you know, my mother Norma and Bon got on famously. He really missed the domestic family side of things. You know, by his own admissions, he was a great bunch of guys.
Yeah.
But I can't talk about it without, you know, having a big smile on my face, you know. And what's been, no point raking over, you know, old stories in it, but, you know, it's far as being an out of control guy who drank too much and did other things. If he was doing that all the time, he was hiding it pretty well, man. He was. You can't be that sharp and that much on the ball if you're wrecking your life.
Was he just writing lyrics all the time? Would you look over and he's just jotting stuff down or you know, how did
yeah,
that
Yeah, he had like, yeah, he just had books. He had these, here in Australia, we used to have these what were they called? They're called exercise books. Kids having primary school, elementary school, and junior high. Just, you know, just pads, you know.
Notebooks.
And he'd always be writing down things, you know. And he had a great turn of phrase, man. Some of the lyrics to things like waiting around to be a millionaire. That's gold, you know, and even, you know, the early stuff like Long Way to the Top, you know, it's just, I remember Bon and Angry having a conversation at the back of a gig one time, and Bon called and said, likened both himself and Angry, he said, we're street poets, you know, we're just telling, you know, talking about life on the road, you know, and I think because of the lyrics, both with, I know I'm drawing comparisons between AC/DC and Rose Tattoo, because it's the only best way I can explain it. The lyric content of it is this bad boy sort of thing, right?
Oh yeah.
And I think you can't live your life like that, but it's a romantic sort of thing, you know. It's a part of your life in 3 or 4 minutes, so it gets it gets reduced to an essence, so to speak. So, you know, you know, with Angry and Bon writing lyrics like that, you know, it's romantic, if you will. That's just their, it's not the way they live their life, you know.
Yeah, yeah, they're like mini mini movies, you know. They're like mini movies.
And it's like, you know, it's a lot of it's imagery and stuff like that, you know. Like that guy wrote MacArthur's Park. He didn't really leave the cake out in the rain, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But yeah, so yeah, I think because of the content of the lyrics, you know, people sort of then get that idea of in their mind what these guys are like, and that's how they live their life, you know.
Right.
Like I'd be with Bon, and we'd go in bars all over the world, right? We'd go and I'd walk up the bar and we'd be with Bon, and we'd be in Germany. We could be anywhere, right? And people say, gee, your pal looks like Bon Scott. I said, oh, yeah, a lot of people say that, you know, because they didn't expect him to be the size that he was, because I'm no giant. I'm barely 5'6". But if you look at the old photos, I look like Lyle Alzado, or so I should be like a linebacker or something. I look like this big, massive guy. And that's because the other guys are shorter than me, you know?
Right.
But I walk in there and tell you, mate, looks like Bon Scott. And I say, a lot of people say, I'm having a bit of luck. And it wouldn't be until they started talking to him and heard his voice and saw his smile. Because he had this great smile. Everything had light up. And then it turned into a leer occasionally, which would be quite funny. But, you know, they realized it was him. But, like, he was noticeably, you know, 5'5", something like that. And he had this onstage presence, which were huge. Or have you met Angus and Malcolm somewhere along the line? You know what I mean about their height then?
Yeah.
When you first meet them, it's incredible, isn't it? You don't expect them.
I saw him in 78, and I'm a kid. I'm really small. So Bon is up there commanding it with that pose, and he looks giant because the stage is like 20 feet up, you know?
Yeah, and his presence is as huge.
Yeah. But then when I met Angus and Brian, I was like, whoa, these guys.
What happened?
I'm fucking taller than these guys, and I'm only 5'7". You know, it's like.
you're a little bit bigger than me then. Take time out, you see those old photos. Mate, I could be playing for the Lakers with a size like that. You know, I thought it was tall. I honestly did. And I got my butt kicked out of the band. I thought, gee, there's other people around a bit taller than me, you know. But yeah, as you would have picked up, but yeah, I really cherish my time with the guys, and we did some great things, and it didn't really work out the way I would have liked to have worked out. But you know, I think the way it's worked out for the band is exactly how it should have. You know, it was after the dust settled down after I got sacked from the band, you know, it became pretty obvious that I wasn't the right guy for the band, and it's very obvious that Cliff is. That's one of the things I'm really really pleased that I may have this wrong, but I think at some stage Cliff hung up the guns. I think he announced his retirement from the band. If would that be correct?
I talked to him. He did retire, but now he's back in, and they did the record. And if they were going to tour, he said he would do some shows with them. But he is, he said he didn't want to do a 2-year tour, which I understood because he's at an age now.
Oh, man. Well, yeah, you can understand that completely. But that's one thing I mentioned before. You know, I think it's, you know, the lineup of the band now is exactly how it should be, you know. In a perfect world, you've got Mal there too, but like it's pretty much basically Stevie's in for Malcolm. That's basically the back and black lineup, I think, isn't it?
Absolutely.
That'd be, and that's the way it should be, and it's a natural, you know. I think things got a bit sort of murky there for a little while.
Well, when you're going 45 years, There's no manual on that. I mean, the Stones have had many players in the band, you know.
Sure.
Brian Jones, of course. Ron Wood. You've got Mick Taylor. And, you know, they've gone through three guys, and there's still the core there. But, yeah. It does get a little murky, because when you have guys that are alive but they're not in the band, then you're constantly in your mind going, God, I wonder if Phil would be back there again, you know, or whatever. But
yeah,
at the end of the day, thank God that we had whoever filled in Simon Wright or Chris Slade, and then Stevie back on the first time to keep the machine going, because we got AC/DC
For sure. I never saw the band with Simon playing, but I've got to know Simon relatively well over the last few years. He's a great drummer. I saw the band, which gig was it? Donington. Once is right out of the gig. There was Metallica and like Black Crowes and Motley Crue.
Oh yeah.
And it was the first time I'd seen the band, or the only time I've seen the band without Phil playing drums. And it took me a while to work out what it was. I was like, this is a bit, and it was different, you
different feel.
But hey, listen, the crowd loved it. It was a great album and fantastic. But, you know, I mentioned it before, you know, Phil's, he's got to be there, you know, yeah. It's like Charlie, you know. Anyway, you know how I feel.
Can you tell me how the firing went down? Was it a management call? Was it Malcolm? And why did you get fired? Was it a vocal thing, or was you guys just butting heads, you and Angus? What was it?
Well, when it happened, it wasn't so much a surprise. It was still a bit of a shock, you know. The band had hit a little bit of a flat spot, because we were touring in Europe with Black Sabbath, and what we were going to do, we were going to go through that tour, we were going to finish in Helsinki, and then we were going to be going straight to the States. But in that period of when we went back and started the European tour, it was very early 1977. For all intents and purposes, I don't think it was at Atlantic at the time. It was definitely Jerry Greenberg. I think the label were released in the States. I think it would have been ATCO or something like that. But it was Atlantic, yeah. So they dropped the band. They were out. So we didn't have a deal in America. Because they heard Dirty Deeds and said, nah, we're not releasing it. You know, seems incredible now, but that was it. So that was sort of, you know, destabilized. I don't know. They had, you know, things a bit rocky. And then we're out on the road with Black Sabbath, and a few things happened on that tour that, you know, I had a bit of a run in, with Angus. I think I got up his nose about something. If I had been a bit more mature, and maybe not drank so much, I would be able to handle the situation better. And then Malcolm, got into a stink with Geezer Butler.
Oh, really?
For some reason, I don't know how it happened, but Malcolm it had a full dance card with the drinks that night, and he went back to the hotel with Black Sabbath. I wasn't there, but for some reason, he ended up knocking out Geezer Butler.
Whoa, knocking him out?
I don't know why. Knocked him. Yeah, KO'd him. There was a story that, you know, someone had a gun or someone had a knife. And the next morning, when we were going out of town, and Malcolm said, "I've got to stop at the hotel and go in there." And what was he going into the hotel for? You know, Black Sabbath Hotel, because we really wouldn't have anything to do with a lot of other bands, except we had a fair bit to do with Ozzy, because Bon and Ozzy, you know, sort of linked up. Man, if you want a wild night in on the Reeper Barn in Hamburg, go out with Ozzy and Bon together. Man, a wrecking machine.
Wow.
But anyway, back to the story. Yeah, there was some. So anyway, Malcolm ended up clocking Geezer, went to the hotel. He came out and said, "Oh, it's not looking good." And we were kicked off the tour. So we had about a month. So we got thrown off the tour because of it. And then there was, you know, much, you know, gnashing of teeth and, you know. And then during that period, I turned 21 years old, right? So we're in London, and the guys threw me a great party in this beer, German beer cellar on Edgware Road. Monster of party, right? So the person shall rename, will remain nameless at this stage, but it was someone, it was a brother of someone who was around the band, right, come up to me, said, "Oh, happy birthday, mate. You know, yeah, that's great. So it's a great party you're having here." I said, "Yeah, that's really good. You know, that's great." He said, "You know, so how come you're leaving the band?" And I went, "What?" He said, yeah, you're finishing up soon, I believe. I got told. Hey, what are you fucking talking about? And then the member of the crew, whose brother, and he came out and said, "Hey, what is this?" He said, your brother's told me I'm leaving the band." And he said, "Oh, really?" That was it. That's how I found out I was going out of the band.
Wow.
But, I think it's the first time I've actually mentioned this in an interview. But I mentioned it. I wrote a memoir. I know that it's in there. That's how it actually happened. And then it was about so why I bailed out from the party. I said, "Oh, fuck this," and took off. And they had like a cake and happy birthday mark and all that. And I wasn't there. I got the shits. Went outside, caught a cab, went to the speakeasy, and got myself tanked up at the speakeasy. I ran into a couple of guys in different bands there, and I said, "Oh, happy at a birthday party at the speakeasy with these a couple of guys from Thin Lizzy and stuff like that." Anyway, long story, but yeah, so I just batted it off. I thought, "This has got to be bullshit," you know. But anyway, it wasn't. But that's life, man. You know, I shit happens. And you asked about the actual meeting, and it was put to me at that stage by Malcolm that they wanted to get someone in that can do backing vocals.
Right.
Basically, that's what it was.
Right.
You know, I think it went deeper than that. And they said, "Well, you don't sing." You know, no one asked me. I actually do sing. You know, I've always done any band I've been doing backing vocals, every band except ACDC.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Although in TNT, I go, oi, I'm on the record doing that. But but I've got a philosophical attitude to it. You know, some people could get bent out of shape by something like that happened, but, you know, I look back and I've just nothing but good memories, you know. A lot of love and respect for the band.
Do you remember that Jailbreak video shoot? Let's talk a little bit about that. It's a fun video, and it was a really, really early video. What was that like?
Well, see, that's what I was saying before. There was a real sense of humor about that band, you know. And like, for God's sake, well, we're dressed up as policemen. Like Phil and Bonner dressed up. It's like prisoners, I think. And then Angus has got that outfit he's gone on. They were made at the time, but they were pajamas. He's got on, and it's got the arrows on it, like a prisoner. And that was all a doing of I mentioned before. The TV show called Countdown. The guy running it, Ian Meldrum. He's known as Molly Meldrum. He was the guy behind all that. He was also the guy behind The Long Way to the Top film clip, the one on the back of the truck.
Yeah.
All those two clips were filmed exclusively for Countdown.
Oh, wow.
Which is, it's on ABC TV, which is ABC TV in Australia. It was, it's a government-run TV station. And so it was national TV. So that's a lot to do with the band making a lot of ground here in Australia. The show was on at 6:30 Sunday night. It was in competition on against Disneyland on another channel, but people used to watch Australia wide. It was like, you know, people used to sit down and watch Countdown, and now it's repeated the following Saturday. So if you were on, we were on Countdown like every second week, which basically meant we're on every week because you're on Saturday and Sunday. But that was that Jailbreak clip and Long Way Top were very much Ian Meldrum's doing, and we had the government supporting us. There you go, and that was just got great clips.
No, they're incredible. They're pieces of history of the band too. Thank God that stuff exists out there. You know that stuff, and you know, Rock Goes to School. All these early stuff of AC/DC that were included in box sets later on.
Yeah. With there was no health and safety people on the side of that Jailbreak clip, because you know those explosions were going off. What they were these really thick, closed at one end metal canisters, like, you know, almost 1 inch thick metal, but the mouth of them was maybe, you know, like this. What they do, they get a plastic bottle, like a big fruit juice quart bottle of petrol, put it in this tube, then throw all dust and leaves and stuff, and then some guy had let it off. And it's this gigantic thing of flames that come up. And they said, okay, we're gonna let some explosions off. When they go off, don't react to them. Oh, okay, fine. And it's like, and the back of my hair, you could, on the back of my hair, if you, it got rid of all the split ends, or it singed all the back of my hair. And you don't react to them, mate. I nearly shit my pants, I'm telling you. But it was done at a quarry in the inner suburbs of western suburbs of Melbourne, a suburb called Sunshine, very working class area. And it's very interesting, when Bon Scott and his family first come to Australia, they were in Melbourne. And we call it primary school. I think you guys call it elementary school.
Yep.
The school you go to when you're 5 or 6 years old. Bon went to Sunshine Primary School. He went to, his primary school was only about 300 or 400 yards from where that quarry was.
Wow.
That's one of those weird coincidences.
Yeah. Can you remember where you were when you heard Bon died?
Yeah, sure can. I was at home. I'd just been recently married, and actually when Bon was in Sydney, he used to come and stay with us, with my wife and I, or he used to be down at a hotel just down the road. I think if anything, my relationship with Bon got a bit closer when I was out of the band, because Bon had a tendency to, if there was a chance to move outside the band circle, he would. Like, he would, you know, we always had band houses. He'd always be the first one to settle with a young lady outside the band. You know, he did like some space. That's probably had a little bit to do with the difference in ages, or the fact that he's been on the road pretty much constantly for about 15 years at that stage. But I was at home in Randwick, and a good pal of mine who was managing a band I was in the time, a guy called Brian Todd, called me up and said, "Oh, what are you doing?" I said, "I'm just here reading a book." He said, "Oh, okay." He got the TV on or listened to any radio. I said, nah. He said, "Oh, okay. I'm about 5 minutes away. I'll come around. I'm bringing a bottle of scotch." And I said, Brian's not much of a drinker. I thought, that's a bit of a weird thing to say. And then he a little while later, knock on the door, and, hey, Brian, come on in. And it's one of those things. You when something's happened, you know by someone's face when you see them. Yep. And you go, and automatically I said, what's happened? You know? And he said, oh, it's Bond, you know, whatever. And after that, my recollection is not all that clear up until the guys got back into Sydney, which, once again, the time frame is a little bit out of whack, I guess. But by the time they got back to Sydney, because they came into Sydney first and went over to Perth for the funeral. But it's a bit of a blur, really. And I remember being in a hotel, because as soon as Phil got into town, he called me. He said, listen, come over. So I was at where the band used to stay, at a place called the Hyatt, Kingsgate Hyatt. And normally that's where Bon and him, Phil, would stay. Obviously, Bon wasn't staying there. So we had a bit of a chat, and it was good to catch up with Phil. And I saw Angus and Malcolm briefly at that stage, but it was just, I don't know. My recollection at the time is not all that clear. You know, it's like losing anyone that's close to you. It's just a shock. And it's, you know, over the years, everyone goes through those sort of things. But that's why I've got even more respect and love for Angus these days, because, you know, what he's been through in the last few years.
Brutal.
It's not my position to comment on it, but, you know, pretty amazing. And that's why it's so good that it's the band's gearing up and getting rolling.
Yeah.
Just as you knew AC/DC would.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the thing. And I love what's happening, you know, because this year, if you look back in this year, 2020, you know, it's getting towards the end of the year with all this COVID stuff, and it's not something people of our generations have experienced before. It's been a shit of a year. It's surprising to me how fast it seemed to have gone this year. But to me, I'm going to be looking back, and this is getting towards the end of the year, and I think the AC/DC brewing up and doing what they're doing, it's a good news story of the year, man. I don't know why anyone should have doubted that it was going to be any different. It's just the way it is. It rolls on, man. It rolls on. So look forward to the next chapter.
Yeah, absolutely. I love the positivity. I mean, it could go somewhere so different with you, especially after what happened with the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and stuff like that. But I really enjoy your positive attitude on the whole thing, which is really rare in an ex band member. A lot of times when you talk to them, you know what I'm saying? There's a lot of bands are weird, man. It's four or five people. You travel together. There's business involved later on. And then it gets crazy and stuff blows to the side. So it's great to talk to you about this stuff, because I'm a huge fan of the band, and I always wanted to know this history of you being in the group, you know?
Yeah. Well, I've got, you know, it's just an attitude that, you know, that's how I deal with things. Angry calls me the eternal optimist.
But
I do think it's you just got to look at what you do, and I look at a lot of things in life the same way. Is I look at people that get bitter, or particularly people get angry, or cut up about things. To have anger in you, it's wasted energy, you know. Like, you can be doing that other good stuff, you know, with that energy, and what are you going to do? Tie yourself up about in knots of things that don't go your way, you know. Like, as I said before, you know, Cliff is obviously the right guy for the job, and the proof's in the pudding. And you look at it and go, I got to tell you, you know, I'm in a very, very fortunate position because, you know, I'm playing with the way Rose Tattoo and AC/DC have been linked on together over the years. It just seems to be something that the way it's turned out these days, it just seems to be right the way it's turned out. And that's, you know, I'm not being stupid saying it was preordained or whatever, anything mystical. Just the way it's turned out right. This is right what's going on now. And so, hey, I say enjoy it. And I'm looking forward to seeing some AC/DC gigs.
I'm so happy you're in Rose Tattoo. I was really looking forward to seeing you in Rose Tattoo.
Me too.
At the Whiskey, you know, I was like, yeah, I'm ready for this.
Oh, you know, isn't it amazing? We sold out 3 nights there. Hey, I know it's not the size of the Forum, and I know it's a little club, but it was going to be a great way to start up. I think it's going to be. You know what? Once again, I think things work out. You know, I think it's going to pan out. It's going to be really interesting for Rose Tattoo now. Because of the way it is my pals, like Ian Ryland had started the band off with Pete and then Mick. I used to play football with Mick a lot when we were kids, you know. And, you know, it's, I'm telling you, it's unfinished business, man.
Yeah.
And we're, you know, it's Angry's call about, you know, what happens and the longevity of the band or whatever. It's his decision. It's Angry's band.
Yeah.
But I'm enjoying it, and I'm on record. It's been my favorite band for the last 40 years. I just love the band. And it just seems right at the moment, you know. The world is good.
Angry was telling me that you are a vintage guitar connoisseur, and I absolutely love vintage guitars. I collected them for years. I sold them like you. I flipped guitars to make a living and to
all
eat.
All right.
And I've owned pretty much every vintage guitar there was, except for a Carina V or Explorer or 59 Paul. But I've had them all, the Juniors, the TV Deluxes, the Tele Esquires, the Blackguard.
I tell you, I can tell you, I know where there's a really nice Carina V.
Oh, yeah?
Yours for $700,000.
Wow. Where is it?
They're getting up. Oh, yeah, mate. If I tell you, I'm going to have to kill you.
Ah, yeah, yeah. Because, you know, Kirk Hammett's a friend of mine, and I had him on the show, and he's got the Peter Green. But he had, like, at one point, I think he had 14 Carina V's. You know, there's only like 100 made or something. I don't know what.
Well, I've got to tell you, I got to, when I was mentioning before that I was at Donington. Yeah. For the Monsters of Rock show. I was there with the guys from Metallica.
Yeah.
Because we've got some mutual friends. But I've got some beautiful, nice old Strats. He was just the band. He talked out of me, one of my favorite basses I've ever had, right? He finally got it out of me. I had a 1968 Paisley Telecaster bass.
Right.
That was originally made, and it was originally made as a fretless bass, right?
Whoa.
But the guy that and it's the bass, I've got the provenance. It's the bass that was on the Morrison Hotel, the Doors album.
Really?
Yeah. So anyway, the guy that got had it before me had it fretted, right? Because he couldn't. Who can play fretless bass? I don't know, you know.
Yeah.
But there was a guy called Steve Kilby from the Church, an Australian band called the Church. He had it, and then I got it, and Jason got it out of me.
Jason Newsted.
But
huh?
Yeah, I love old guitars, man. Yeah. He's got it now. But that's a bass that was not there. But I've had some great things happen with vintage guitars. I love old Gibson J200s. Got a stack of those. And,
great.
I've gone nuts on Firebirds. I have the Thunderbirds, rather, with the bases with where I said I have them all painted matte black with, you know, they look like motorcycles. They're great. So I think there's about half a dozen of those, and lots of nice old Chellies. I had early 1960s Les Paul.
Yeah.
Regrettably, I let that go.
Yeah.
But, hey.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's good. I just love that. And what got me into collecting, it was being in London with AC/DC. I've got a 1966 Olympic White Precision bass. It's one of the ones like John Entwistle had, the one that the slab body thing. But I've still got that, you know. God, love all that stuff. So you're a guitar fan too. Great.
Oh, love them, dude. I love them. I think there's three of the greatest guitars ever made. One is the 50, 51, 52 Blackguard Esquire. I think those are incredible. One pickup, just rock and roll machine. The 59 Les Paul and Flame Top. And then I love the 58 Carina V and Explorers because they're just so weird that came out in 58. And
they call them the futuristic guitars. There's that other guitar that's supposed to be the Gibson Modern.
Yeah, too, the Modern, the Gumby with the Gumby headstock.
I was doing a little bit of research in it, and I heard you. You did an interview with Grover Jackson recently.
Yeah, just did it. Just did 4 hours with him.
Well, it's very interesting. When he first started Jackson Guitars, it was out in a place called
Sandinas.
That's it.
Yeah.
I went out there with I was with Heaven at the time playing guitar.
Yeah.
Went out there with our guitar player, a guy called Kelly, and he had he designed the Kelly shaped guitar.
Yeah, right? the Kelly.
Which they still make. Right now, he had two Kellys made for him, which were number 2 and 3 Jacksons. I had a Telecaster made for me, which was the number 4 Jackson.
Wow.
The number 1 was the first one he was making out there was the first Randy Rhodes.
Right.
So that's the first 4 Jackson guitars that Grover actually made.
Wow.
Out at San Dimas, which would have been 1980. The end of 1983.
Oh, 83.
Yeah, he's a great dude, man. He knows his biscuits.
Oh God, yeah. Let's close this out with a little bit of Heaven talk. That record, you know, was where Angels Fear to Tread was. It was kind of hot in the U.S. for a minute. It had a Saxon sound, big time. I love the song Love Child, and the title track was fantastic too. I did see them open for somebody. I'm not sure. It might have been Motley. It might have been Sabbath on the Ian Gillan tour. It was one of those. But
the Motley Crue tour we did was the Shout at the Devil tour.
Yeah,
and then the tour we did after that was supporting Black Sabbath.
Born Again.
And it was Gillan. It was Gillan was singing, and there was another guy playing drums and a big monstrous.
The dude from UFO or from ELO. The guy from ELO.
Yeah, Bev. Yeah. Bev. Yeah, Bev someone. Yeah.
That's it.
Do you remember when Sabbath come out? They come out through like Stonehenge.
Yeah, remember that? Yeah.
I think that's a little bit Spinal Tapish, isn't it? I think I always thought they'd have to. I'm glad you remembered that because I've told people that. They say, oh, get out of here. I said, I'm telling them they come out for a stone. That's what they did. Yeah. No. And the monitors were in, like, rocks and stuff.
Yeah, the monitors were in rocks.
Oh, my God.
Ian Gillan had all the lyrics on the ground on paper.
Yeah, and he had it in a big book.
Yeah, big book. Remember that?
And he should have just got a teleprompter or something. He reached down and turned the pages.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I remember watching a documentary. He said that smoke came out and he couldn't read them.
and they used smoke on the water as an encore.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's bizarre, Tom. Yeah, Heaven was great. Interestingly enough, there's a bit of a musical chairs thing there. a guy I was working with, John Layla, a drummer of mine who was in heaven with me. We had a band together in Australia called The Beast, which was the guitar player singing was Robin Riley. So what happened, the band broke up because Rob got asked to join Rose Tattoo in England and Mick Cox came back to Australia. Then Mick Cox goes to LA and joins Heaven. Mick Cox finishes up in Heaven. I go over and take over from Mick Cox. There's all these intertwined things between, you know, and of course, you know, and Heaven was managed by Michael Browning and Coral Browning, who were very instrumental in getting AC/DC off the ground. If it wasn't for Albert's Productions and then Michael Browning coming on board managing AC/DC, I think the story's a lot different without Michael's input. Michael was a guy, along with Coral, his sister, that got the band overseas and pushed it, you know, and was it the guy at the coalface that made all the ideas that Malcolm and Angus and George had. He was the guy who was he was in the trenches, man. Without Michael, I think it's a different story, you know. He's wow. still around. He's still, you know, he's living here in Sydney. Nice place to live, Sydney.
Yeah, I bet. I bet it's beautiful. I've not gone there yet. I got to get over there and do comedy. They got a huge comedy scene. I'm a comedian, and my podcast is big over there, man. So I'm dying to get over there. Melbourne Comedy Fest, Sydney Comedy Fest, all these great ones.
Yeah, you stand up, huh?
Yeah.
Well, a lot of people told I should do stand up too, you know. But you know, hey, I get enough laughs out of my bass playing, you know.
Go do it, man. Go. How old are you now?
Me, 64.
Okay, you look great, man. You look great.
Oh, mate, yeah. Oh, it's only midday here. It's early in the day, you know.
Well, thanks for doing the show, and it was fantastic to talk to you. I want to thank my buddy Mark Brunot, who set this up, man. He is an Australian super fan of my podcast and a great friend, and he set it up. And I'm really
fantastic.
I'm really hoping to meet you and Angry in person once this COVID's gone, and we'll hang out and shoot the shit. And it's
with Rose Tattoo, it's like I said, it's unfinished business. I can't tell exactly when, but I know we're going to be doing the States, and we may have a couple of quiet, refreshing drinks at the Whiskey. What do you think?
We'll do that, and I'll come down to soundcheck and just hear you run 1 minute of that live wire, man. Just doon, 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 doon. That's my that song makes my fucking hair stand up, man. It's just
one of my favorites too.
Dude, man. It is fire. It is fire, dude.
Oh, mate, I've got a thing. If you can't play bass when you got Phil Rudd on drums and Malcolm Young on the rhythm guitar, if you can't play bass to that, get a new career path because you're shot, man. Okay. All right. Great to speak with you, pal.
I love you, Mark. Care. Thank you so much, man. Candles lit, buddy.
All right, then. You take care, man.
All right. See ya.
See ya.